And secondly, for course projects, just bring your proposal to Raymond or myself, and we'll have a look at it and make sure it looks reasonable. Essentially, anything on the topics covered in the course and the topics covered in the previous version of the course is fair game. That's pretty much obvious. And then if you have anything outside of that, then you know, be sure to write down a concrete proposal with one paragraph and some references that we could have a look at. I mean, in fact, that should be your proposal no matter what. It should be about a paragraph with some references of what you plan to do. So you can cover any of the modern interpretations or other foundational aspects of quantum mechanics in the project. Okay, so let's pick up where we left off then last lecture, where we were in the middle of discussing the orthodox interpretation of von Neumann and Dirac and how they had a notion of completeness and what I call literal realism. So there, I'm not seeing my, never mind. Normally I see the, Okay, so basically the key idea of the orthodox interpretation was that pure quantum states provide the fundamental ontology for the world. And the idea that not only the quantum states are ontological, that they have some kind of physical existence, but that they provide the complete ontology, so in other words, the ontology of the world is just the quantum state vector, is what I mean when I say literal realism. So you take reality to be literally just the wave function. And I mentioned last class an important point, which is this is kind of a psychologically natural interpretation for physicists who see quantum theory as the fundamental theory of nature, and therefore the central mathematical object should have a fundamental ontic status. And then we discussed how you needed a projection postulate for the theory to be empirically consistent. And then we got to the point of making sense of what does it mean to have this projection postulate in addition to the Schrodinger unitary evolution. And so von Neumann goes through an analysis saying, look, so we basically have seen that we need this projection postulate from an empirical point of view. And it's not really an interpretational issue, it's an empirical issue. If we want to be able to predict the outcomes of future experiments, the state conditioned upon the observation, the outcome of the measurement has to be updated in this non-unitary way. So von Neumann's main point is that this means we have to create this kind of divide between, you know, the observed world and the observing world. And also he goes through great pains to explain that where you apply this division is to some extent arbitrary, and that's just the way it is. So he has lots of quotes like this, which I guess I'll just, to warm us up, I'll read through. So he says, we must divide the world into two parts, the one being the observed system, the other the observer. In the former, we can follow up all physical processes arbitrarily precisely. In the latter, this is meaningless. The boundary between the two is arbitrary to a very large extent. That this boundary can be pushed arbitrarily deeply into the interior of the body of the actual observer is the content of the principle of psychophysical parallelism. But this does not change the fact that in each method of description, the boundary must be put somewhere if the method is not to proceed vacuously, i.e. if a comparison with experiment is to be possible. Then he points out that there's this dual form where on the one hand, in the one part of the divide, you have unitary evolution, and to get to the other side of the divide, you need the projection postulate. So, I mean, it's almost painful to read how von Neumann's justifying this, but it's kind of a consequence of the point of view that he's adopted and that others in that community at the time in the 30s and 40s have adopted. So I'll just skip this quote because I have too much material for today anyways, but you can read it when the notes are available online. Let me just say also, by the way, so I posted the notes online for the first two lectures, and I've noticed that something about Beamer is that I think if you printed it out, when I have these bullet points that arise periodically, I think that's one page per bullet point. But there's a way to overcome that, which I haven't sorted out yet. So I will take care of that this weekend, put updated notes that you could actually print out as like one slide at a time. So another important point to realize is that if you take this, you know, this kind of simplest interpretation, this literal realism, then it means that the projection postulate, which many of you might already have a more sophisticated understanding of as an update of information, on this, you know, kind of older view, in the view of literal realism, the projection postulate is a physical transformation, which Dirac describes as an actual jump of the, you know, properties of the world. So Dirac emphasizes, as late as 1958, when we measure a real dynamical variable, the disturbance involved in the act of measurement causes a jump in the state of the dynamical system. From physical continuity, if we make a second measurement of the same dynamical variable immediately after the first, the result of the second must be the same as that of the first, because this is von Neumann's argument, basically. Hence, after the first measurement has been made, the system must be in an eigenstate of the dynamical variable, namely the eigenvalue it belongs to being equal to the result of the first measurement. And this conclusion must hold even if the second measurement is not made. This jump has to occur. And so in this way, we see that measurement causes the system to physically jump. Now, also, there are other consequences of this, such as now all of a sudden the theory is not causal anymore, because you have this stochastic, this random process of the jump to the actual random outcome. And, you know, I was discussing this with Chris last week, and basically, you know, it became clear to him from these considerations that, and this is a point I'll underscore later, this loss of causality is a consequence of the interpretation. It's not a necessary implication of quantum mechanics. So here von Neumann says, the question of causality could be put to a true test only in the atom. I don't even know what the point of this is, but this is the only formal existing, what I found interesting about this quote, beside the fact that he drops causality, is the fact that he describes quantum mechanics as the only theory existing at the present time which orders and summarizes our experiences in this area in a halfway satisfactory manner. Well, now we know it's a fully satisfactory manner, so it's not just halfway, which I guess it was back then. But it's interesting that in spite of the fact that kind of the experimental evidence was somewhat limited in the 30s, he still didn't even consider the fact that quantum mechanics would be a phenomenological theory or an incomplete theory. So even now, in hindsight, it's even harder, so to speak, to take that step and say, well, maybe quantum mechanics isn't complete. But here, even then, he didn't want to make that step, but instead was prepared to abandon causality. Yes?
That you have to get rid of causality, is it because when you do a measurement, then the result is not deterministic?
Yes. Well, if you have exactly the same experimental conditions, and you repeat it, you get different random outcomes. But you know you can correctly describe the situation before the measurement by a pure state. So on the assumption the pure state is the complete physical status of the world, the fact that you get different outcomes in spite of the ontology being fully determined by the state means that you have some kind of stochastic element, some random element.
Yeah, but I would just call that indeterministic. I wouldn't call that non-causal. Because I still know, I mean, I will know certain probabilities of certain outcomes only, not precise outcomes. But those outcomes are still generated by the act of measurement, so it's still causal.
Well, the fact that you get an outcome is causal, but which outcome you get is not causal.
Okay, so they just call it non-causal.
Yeah, I'm not going to parse the term causality, so I'm not going to defend this rigorously. I mean, the point is there's, you know, there's something fishy going on in case of that. You can parse the word causality in different ways. In fact, that's a whole business in philosophy. So, okay, here's another quote from von Neumann, just which I think brings out a lot of these issues. So he says, this concept of quantum mechanics, which accepts its statistical expression as the actual form of the laws of nature and which abandons the principle of causality, is the so-called statistical interpretation. So first of all, this is kind of disturbing to me because he's using the label statistical interpretation to refer to this literal realism he holds, whereas nowadays the label statistical interpretation refers to the exact opposite point of view, namely the view advocated by Einstein and Leslie Ballantyne, which is that quantum states do not give a complete description of the ontology of the system, that they only describe ensembles of system, which we'll see later. So, anyway, just, I found that a bit surprising. I guess maybe he calls it statistical because it has this intrinsic stochasticity or something like that. So we have to be very careful with labels and terminology in any of these discussions. Anyways, I just want to underscore again that it is this assumption of completeness which leads to this conclusion. So now we get to one of the most famous paradoxes of quantum mechanics, which is Schrodinger's cat. And so you all probably know this, but let's just go through it really quickly. So Schrodinger imagines that there's a cat in a chamber, and inside the chamber there's a device which is basically a trigger mechanism which can release hydrocyanic acid, just to be precise. And the idea is that it's an atomic decay event which either triggers or does not trigger this vial to be broken. And the idea is that the atom is, of course, after some finite time, in a coherent superposition of either decaying or not decaying. So consequently, the device will be entangled with that state in a coherent superposition of being triggered and not being triggered. And as a result, the cat will be in a coherent superposition of being alive and dead. Now, it's not the state of the cat alone that's a coherent superposition, but the state of the composite system, atom plus device plus cat. And then he concludes by saying, the wave function of the entire system would express this by having it in the living and the dead cat, pardon the expression, mixed or smeared out in equal parts. So I don't know why he pardons the expression dead cat, but that's the idea. Oh, it's for what's coming next. Oh, I see. That solves that mystery. So now here's something which is one of my kind of like pet peeves, I guess, is that often Schrodinger is cited. In fact, I had an argument with Max Schlossauer when he wrote a review on the role of decoherence in interpretations. And I guess I wasn't as polite as I should have been because I was basically belittling this many worlds view that he espoused. And he's like, how can you belittle something that was espoused by, so-so, such-and-such, and Schrodinger? And I wrote back, and I was like, no, not Schrodinger. So here's the idea, is that Schrodinger actually constructed the argument as a reductio ad absurdum to make fun of the conventional view. And in fact, in the actual passage, which Cosman looked up for me, thank you, Cosman, he starts out the quote with, one can even set up quite ridiculous cases. So he's trying to argue that, this is a ridiculous consequence if you take the state being real literally. But unfortunately, that line is left out, and he's thought to be pointing out this is a consequence of quantum mechanics, that cats are simultaneously alive and dead, until we measure them. So this question of whether the cat is finally alive or dead depends on exactly at what point the dynamical process of collapse is supposed to have taken place. So the question is the cat's status, in an undefined state? Is its ontological status undefined until it's observed? Or is the cat's observation in the box sufficient to trigger this measurement process so that it is fully determined because it's an observer? So probably the funniest way to put this was by John Bell, who says, what exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of measurer? Was the wave function of the world waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared? Or did it have to wait a little longer for some better qualified system with a PhD? So what exactly is the threshold at which observation occurs? Is it me or me only if I know quantum mechanics? And this is all addressing this, what von Neumann called this arbitrary but necessary divide between the observer and the observee. So these considerations all kind of globally are what people refer to by the measurement problem. By most accounts, the measurement problem refers specifically to the fact that unitary evolution, fundamental dynamical law of quantum mechanics, fails to account for the individual outcomes of our experience. So whereas we take those individual outcomes to have kind of a real status, independent of what our interpretation is, then all of a sudden the interpretation comes along and says, well, that doesn't have a real status according to the interpretation. So there's that conflict. So then the projection postulate is designed to solve this problem by saying, well, yes, the ontology of, you know, of the orthodox view does give us a single outcome because the collapse occurred. But then this kind of brings in more problems into our interpretation, which is all of a sudden we have a fundamental ontology that's governed by two different dynamical laws, the unitary one and the collapse one, and the question of exactly when this collapse takes place is unspecified. So the measurement problem can also refer to these consequences of the projection postulate. Different people use it differently. In fact, there's yet a third way that the measurement problem is used, and it's usually claimed to be solved in this context. So it's the view that decoherence somehow solves this problem. So as we saw previously, when you take into account an extra environment, degrees of freedom, you know, the atmosphere surrounding the pointer, and then you trace over that environment, you're left in this incoherent mixture of the pointer being left and right. And so first of all, let's point out that if it's a pointer corresponding to a measurement, then just the fact that we've traced over the atomic system already gives us this mixture, right? So we don't have to actually include the environment to get this result. It comes automatically from the fact that we're doing a measurement of an atomic system, a faithful measurement. But so what this does do for us is it explains why the pointer behaves classically in the sense of when we perform operations on it. So I can't go and do some experiment on the pointer in practice. If I try and do some kind of experiment showing the pointer is in a coherent superposition, that experiment will fail. I will not see interference effects in the pointer. That's a practical realization. And the question is, well, why? Well, and the answer is decoherence. So decoherence explains why the state of the pointer doesn't exhibit quantum effects, namely interference effects. So this provides some partial solution to the problem in the sense that it explains why the pointer has classical properties from the point of view of empirical tests. But it doesn't explain the measurement problem, which is how do we have an interpretation which tells us what is real, and at the same time that gives us a single pointer outcome as being the definite case, without this ambiguity of some, you know, measurement that's loosely defined. Now, this is something that von Neumann realized all the way back in 1932, which is that basically the mixed state doesn't answer the full problem. We need something more, and that's why he introduced the collapse postulate. So within the orthodox view of von Neumann and Dirac, and this is kind of my claim, which I think many other people agree with, but many people don't agree with, decoherence buys you nothing, basically. It doesn't solve the problem at all in that context. Yeah.
Like, so you're saying then that this decoherence just explains why the measurement device behaves classically. It doesn't actually solve the measurement problem itself. Is that what
right.
I mean?
Right.
Okay.
So it doesn't explain the problem of ontology. It just gives you a description of the device that's consistent with your any subsequent experiments you would do on the pointer.
Heisenberg answered in principle that you would always be able to end up with a single unique measurement value.
Well, I think if it's in a localized eigenstate of position, then it's in a superposition of momenta, which of course it doesn't actually do, right? So, no, I think the idea is that you could have some coherent state which ascribes a well-defined position of momentum to within experimental resolution. In fact, that's what the decoherence program tries to show, is that you get these stable coherence states.
As a question, Paolo, you're saying that the decoherence program does not solve the problem because you get a density matrix and it doesn't pick up one particle
right.
value on the diagonal. Mm-hmm. I think that you cannot ever find one interpretation or a reason why you would pick up a single element, a unique one, because that would violate the Heisenberg and Turing principle.
I don't think that's right. I think that the Roy Bohm theory does give you a specific pointer outcome unambiguously. And
exactly how it would not violate the uncertainty principle, I think that might be a subtle issue to show, but I'm sure it wouldn't because it reproduces the predictions of quantum mechanics. So, I mean,
but so we'll get to that. So let me just say, I'm beating up on decoherence. Decoherence does have an important role in interpretations, namely for the incorrect ones. But so cheekiness aside, in modern interpretations such as many worlds and consistent histories, which is now kind of sometimes elevated to decoherent histories, decoherence plays a crucial role for kind of coming up with a self-consistent interpretation within those interpretations, self-consistent interpretational view. So I'm not going to go in and justify those interpretations. That's the job of the speakers, which, by the way, so Lev Weidman will come in mid-March to give us a talk on many worlds. So that'll be fun. So you can challenge him with this in March. But something you can challenge him with is some of kind of my thoughts on you know, the extent to which decoherence can be appealed to justify these other interpretations. No matter what parts of the environment you trace over and what you take for your environment, sure, you're going to get some description of the subsystem that's a mixture as a result of this. But at the end of the day, the composite system is still a pure state. So if I want to talk about the apparatus and the atomic system and the environment, that's still a pure state. So to some extent, it's a bit of a sleight of hand trick in that, well, yes, if I take into account the decoherence and I can talk about subsystems as being mixtures, maybe I can define some preferred basis as a keyword. One of the problems with mixtures, which I didn't mention, is that even if I have a mixture of left plus right like that, any mixture can be expressed. I think I mentioned this in the first lecture or the second. Any mixture can be expressed in an infinite number of different decompositions over pure states. So to say that you've solved the problem by coming up with a convex combination of left and right is actually misleading, because quantum mechanics is silent about what the right convex combination is. So sure, you have a classical mixture, but there's this ambiguity of what the right mixture is. What is the probability distribution over? What are the states you're taking that probability distribution with respect to? And so you still have to confront interpretational issues about the ontology of the composite system, where it is going to be in a pure coherent superposition. So it doesn't really buy you that much, in my view, because of that. And really, to some extent, I think just sweeps the problem under the rug. Now, I'm not an expert on many worlds and decoherent history. So, you know, hopefully when people come and discuss those views, we can challenge them on exactly how well they handle, how much decoherence does for them. But anyways, all that aside, I keep emphasizing to you that the measurement problem, I keep kind of defining it in terms of the orthodox view. So if we're going to reject the orthodox view, which you've probably had plenty of ammunition by now to, well, hopefully, to do, then is this measurement problem really a problem that needs to be solved if you're not going to take this very strong stance of von Neumann and Dirac? So I hope to convince you that no, it's not a problem of quantum mechanics. It's a problem of the orthodox interpretation. Other modern interpretations have a form of the measurement problem, but it's interpretation specific. So my favorite quote about this is by Hideo Mabuchi, who's actually a contemporary scientist at Caltech, and he describes the measurement problem as a set of people. So it's namely people who take particular interpretational dogmatic views have this problem. So now the drum roll is, well then, for whom is the measurement problem not a problem? Now we come to my hero. Oh, I haven't switched to full screen mode. I find that actually this photo is kind of interesting because it's almost like he's praying because he's, you know, please, why doesn't anybody understand me? So Einstein, all along, he was one of the very first people, if not the first, to point out that, you know, we can avoid all of these problems if we just relinquish this assumption that quantum mechanics gives us a complete description of reality. So certainly as early as 1927, and probably the scholars will tell you earlier, Einstein maintained that we should think of quantum mechanics as giving an incomplete description of reality. So one pertinent quote is in 1949, he says, the attempt to conceive the quantum theoretic theoretical description as the complete description of an individual system leads to unnatural theoretical interpretations, which become immediately unnecessary if one accepts the interpretation that the description refers to ensembles of systems and not to individual systems. Now, we saw Schrodinger's cat argument, and so it turns out Einstein wrote the following to Schrodinger sometime before the Schrodinger cat article was submitted. He's arguing with Schrodinger about how we can show people that the description is incomplete and says, the system, you have a system that's a substance in chemically unstable equilibrium, perhaps a charge of gunpowder that by means of intrinsic forces can spontaneously combust, and where the average lifespan of the whole setup is a year. In principle, this can quite easily be represented quantum mechanically. In the beginning, the psi function characterizes a reasonably well-defined macroscopic state. But according to your equation, after the course of a year, this is no longer the case. Rather, the psi function then describes a sort of blend of not yet and already exploded systems. Through no art of interpretation can this psi function be turned into an adequate description of a real state of affairs. In reality, there is just no intermediary between exploded and non-exploded. So actually, it seems like Einstein gave Schrodinger the key elements of the Schrodinger cat argument, which is to blow up the superposition to the macroscopic scale and show that it leads to absurdity.
We have superposition, which we would probably say are macroscopic. So would that go completely against this, that indeed halfway through your system is in a superposition of macroscopic system being left and right?
So I think that the important thing there is to be careful with the wording, which is saying that the quantum system is described by a coherent superposition means that I have a mathematical object which predicts the properties of that system when it's prepared in this way. And that's the safe thing to say, and Einstein would agree with that. But when you say that the system is in a coherent superposition, where what I mean by coherent superposition is the unnecessary assumption that it's simultaneously existing in different ways, then he would disagree with that. So you can have a physical system that's macroscopic, that's coherent, for which all of the predictions of quantum mechanics work in the Schrodinger picture, but you don't have to commit yourself to the view that that means that the system is physically coexisting in these different states. And so, again, the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation gives you a perfect example of how you can explain the process and get something that agrees with experiment, where everything is pure, coherent, and unitary, but yet everything has a well-defined set of properties at all times. And it's because in that case you take the coherent superposition as a mathematical object, and you don't parse it as a physical object. So that's the key turn. So Ballantyne puts this best, where he says that once you've started thinking of quantum states as real, it's a really hard habit to break. And so I think that's what's at play here, is this you know, changing that perspective on thinking of states as physical objects rather than mathematical objects. And so what I also find amusing is that he just gives credit to Schrodinger for the whole idea anyways, but he melds the two arguments, the two pieces together, and all of a sudden, instead of there being cyanic acid, he describes Schrodinger's cat as being there being a charge of gunpowder in the cat in the box, and basically says, so they somehow believe that the quantum theory provides a description of reality and even a complete description. This interpretation is, however, refuted most elegantly by your system of radioactive atom plus Geiger counter plus amplifier plus charge of gunpowder plus cat in a box, in which the psi function of the system contains the cat both alive and blown to bits. Is the state of the cat to be created only when a physicist investigates the situation at some definite time? Notice the echoes of Bell's quip there. Nobody really doubts that the presence or absence of the cat is something independent of the act of observation. But then the description by means of the wave function is certainly incomplete, meaning it's just some mathematical object. And there must be some more detailed mathematical object that gives us the actual ontology. And then, anyway, so if it wants to believe that quantum theory is final, in the sense of final ontologically, then one must believe that a more complete description would be useless because there would be no laws for it. If that were so, then physics could don't know what that one is. I probably, it's a typo by me there. Then physics could claim the interests of only shopkeepers and engineers. The whole thing would be a wretched bungle. So you can see the frustration creeping into his private communication there. By the way, I put an exclamation mark here because I just love the fact that, you know, instead of saying Schrodinger equation, you can say your equation because he's writing to Schrodinger. So really for Einstein, the key idea was that we should have a notion of reality that's independent of observation, and that we don't have that in Bohr's view or in the orthodox view. And Pauli describes it succinctly quite well. Now, from my conversations with Einstein, I've seen that he takes exception to the assumption, essential to quantum mechanics in Pauli's view, that the state of a system is defined only by specification of an experimental arrangement. So here there's, again, this ambiguity of the word state. I mean, does Pauli mean the quantum wave function, or does he mean the ontological state? So for the orthodox view, those two are synonyms, but we want to remember that these are different concepts and we should have different words for them. Einstein wants to know nothing of this. Einstein has the philosophical prejudice that a state can be defined objectively under any circumstances, that is, without specification of the experimental arrangement used to examine the system. It seems to me that this discussion can be reduced to this hypothesis of his, which I call the ideal of the detached observer. And so later on, we'll see that a lot of the modern interpretations, you know, one of the goals, and there's entire conferences named after this idea, that you want some interpretation without observers. You want a sense of quantum mechanics that makes sense without including an explicit observer in the picture. So now, in the previous lecture, we got kind of gentle with Bohr at the end. I mean, I started out very critical, and I said, you know, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe if we take, when Bohr talks about classical devices and classical instruments, we just replace that with this more modern notion of input-output information, then Bohr's ideas were just, at the end of the day, a very modern operational view, which is the one that everyone should agree on anyway. It's the empirical adequacy, so to speak, of the situation. And but I think that was too favorable, because he wasn't just an operationalist, but really was a staunch anti-realist, like Chris Fuchs, who's probably more of an anti-realist than Bohr even. But we'll find that out soon enough. So Bohr steadfastly refused to acknowledge even the logical possibility of Einstein's perspective being valid. So that goes beyond just saying, look, all we know is this. He's saying, look, that's all we can know, and there's nothing more. Stop asking the question. So in 1949, he goes out and actually says the more complete analysis Einstein seeks is in principle excluded. So I don't think he was just an operationalist. I think he was also a diehard anti-realist. Yeah, Chris. Are realists. Realists in the sense of
out there, and you know, he even there's a Martin Gardner quote that says, that's the most confirmed experimental fact in all the that there exists an external world out there.
All right. Yeah, don't say
it. All right, so, well, okay. I have no idea how we can maintain that, and yes, I guess we'll find out. This will be fun. Yes.
Because, I mean, so then he's a realist, but then the problem is,
how does quantum theory give you that realism, right? How do you get some kind of correspondence? And this is next lecture's discussion. But how do we get a correspondence between elements of the mathematical theory and what we believe to be elements of reality? So probably the most interesting criticism of the orthodox view, because it had such massive ramifications, both conceptually and technologically, came from a criticism in a paper by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen in 1935. So this paper, now known as the EPR paper, or the EPR argument, the goal of it was to show that the notion that quantum mechanics gave a complete description of the world and the notion of locality were incompatible. And for EPR, of course, they showed this incompatibility, and then they went further and said, look, it's obvious locality must hold. Therefore, we have a proof that quantum theory is incomplete. And so this appeared in the New York Times. Einstein attacks quantum theory. Scientists and two colleagues find it is not complete, even though correct. see Fuller one possible. I love that's probably the most concise way to say that he wants a more complete theory. Believe a whole description of the physical reality can be provided eventually. I love it. That would never appear in the New York Times nowadays. So, as you can see, my Beamer, you know, capabilities have improved dramatically over the past 2 weeks. Yes. And I'm cutting and pasting out of articles. Okay, this is great. So what is the EPR argument? So the argument is actually a bit convoluted and unnecessarily convoluted. So Einstein later complained, I don't remember where, probably in the letter to Schrodinger, which was where he did most of his complaining, that, you know, basically he didn't like the way Podolsky wrote the paper. I don't remember for sure, but I think he might have complained that Podolsky submitted it too soon without him getting final revisions, but maybe I'm just misrecollecting. I couldn't find where I heard that from, so I can't provide you with the reference. Oh, please.
Why does the New York Times call Podolsky and Rosen colleagues and not scientists?
Is that what they did?
Yeah.
Yes.
Scientists. Makes they weren't sure who they were.
So the way that the dilemma is put in the EPR paper is that we have two mutually exclusive possibilities, which they seemingly justify that these are mutually exclusive possibilities, but I'm not going to go into whether or not that holds. But what they say is that we have two options. One is that the quantum mechanical description of reality given by the wave function is not complete. And the second is that when operators corresponding to two physical quantities do not commute, the two quantities cannot have simultaneous reality, which is what you get out of the orthodox interpretation. This eigenvalue, eigenstate link tells you that it's only when the state is an eigenvector of that property that you can talk about it having a definite value or objective existence. And so if you have non-commuting observables, then you can never say that for both of them at the same time. So they lay out a necessary condition for completeness of the theory, which is to say that every element of physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. So that means you take your mathematical objects and you take your set corresponding to things that are real, and that you should have a mapping from the mathematical objects that's surjective onto the set of, you know, real properties. So it's onto. So everything that you believe or know exists, the theory gives you a rule, which maps a mathematical element to that element of reality. And of course, they say it's a necessary condition, meaning if you satisfy the condition, the theory might still might not be complete, but this is at least it must have this property. For EPR, a sufficient condition for something to be called real is that, well, look, if without in any way disturbing the physical system, I can predict with certainty the value of some physical quantity, then there must be some element of physical reality corresponding to that quantity. So that's not a necessary condition, but a sufficient condition. So to illustrate the contradiction, what they did is they considered two particles produced in a back-to-back, you know, some kind of decay event that produces two particles which are kind of flying off back-to-back. And the idea is that they're then in a joint eigenstate of relative position and total momentum. So the total momentum is conserved, and the relative distance between them, that's conserved. Those are commuting observables. But it's a bit subtle, and also you have to deal with the intricacies of infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So you can just as well construct the same argument using just two spin half particles. And that's what Bohm did in 1951. He came up with a version of the argument which is now called the EPRB argument. So the idea is you consider two particles in the singlet state. So they're in this coherent superposition of perfect anticorrelation. And it's a state of zero angular momentum, which has this anticorrelation I just mentioned. Now, what you do is you assume that the particles are created in this entangled state and then separated. And now the idea is that if you measure particle one along, say, the z-axis, and you get, say, outcome plus h bar over 2, then you know that particle 2 must give you the outcome minus h bar over 2. But instead, I could choose to measure Sx, the angular momentum along the x-axis, and then I'd be able to predict with certainty whatever outcome I get, the exact value of the outcome for the x measurement of the other particle. That's what quantum mechanics predicts. That's not, you know, there's nothing controversial so far. So the point is that we can predict with certainty the outcomes of either Sx or Sz without in any way disturbing that second particle. So just by measuring the first particle, I can predict exactly what I'll see for the second particle. So this is this assumption of locality that comes in here, which we'll make explicit in a moment, that is saying we'll look away. They're separated, spatially separated. And so I can gain knowledge about the second system without disturbing it. Because they're separated, therefore, by locality, I cannot create any disturbance outside of what's immediate the vicinity of the first particle. So now if we adopt their criterion of reality, their sufficient condition for reality, then it follows that there must be elements of reality corresponding to both Sx and Sz for the second particle. Now notice that this is a counterfactual assumption, which is philosophical jargon for meaning that I'm describing two situations that are actually incompatible. So either I measure Sx and I can definitely predict Sx, so Sx is an element of reality, or I can measure Sz and therefore predict Sz, and that's an element of reality. I can't do both. They're incompatible measurements. So here they're saying, well, because, so this is the assumption of counterfactuality, that because I could do either, therefore I can talk about both of these properties, given that it shouldn't depend on what I decide over here. And now because, as we know, via the eigenvalue, eigenstate link of the orthodox view, we can't assign definite properties, but we've just deduced that both those properties exist. Therefore, it follows that the orthodox view is incomplete. So we don't get a complete assignment of reality that we expect from the orthodox view. Yeah?
Counterfactuality. Really, only if you accept quantum mechanics, you can say that those two are incompatible statements. But if you don't, so if he had some more fundamental theory in mind, this situation wouldn't be counterfactual. So you could, by the new theory, make simultaneously an experiment determining all components of spin. So I've never clearly understood this fact about counterfactuality here.
Well, I think that the point is you don't want to start disputing the empirical properties of quantum mechanics. I mean, sure, they may ultimately be wrong, but empirically we know of no way to measure Sx and Sz simultaneously. So rather than, you know, why complicate the argument by allowing for the possibility of quantum mechanics being wrong and that there is some way to actually measure Sx and Sz? Well, I guess you avoid counterfactuality is the reason for doing that, but
limited. It describes some experiments, but there are other experiments which quantum mechanics does not describe.
Well, maybe that would work. Maybe that would work, but that's certainly not what they did. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could say much more about it.
Theories right now. So,
but if the goal, what you're saying is you're trying to do this to avoid this counterfactualist, or you're trying to say it's not really counterfactual, it's only counterfactual if you believe quantum mechanics is the best we can do. Well, I think that's a safe assumption for now. This is the quantum mechanics is the best we can do.
There is no procedure to measure them simultaneously, so you cannot assume that they exist simultaneously. It's nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
Yes, and this is Bohr's response.
Yes.
So we'll see that. So one of the key ideas. So the EPR argument is largely obsolete now because of Bell's theorem. But what it did do is it brought to everyone's attention, or at least to later scientists, the idea that, look, there's something really special about entangled states and a conflict between entangled states and our traditional notion of separability and locality. So let's just highlight that for now because it comes up later. So what they do is they assume a notion of separability, which is that it's possible to attribute some kind of notion of reality to one system independently of what reality is attributed to the other system. which is a fairly standard notion of reality pre-quantum mechanics. And they also assume a notion of independence. I took this from reading some, philosophers' takes on this, and this gets parsed. The amount of parsing of the language is just phenomenal. But so you have these distinct, subtly distinct notions of separability, independence, and locality. But the idea is that they're motivated. Separability, independence are motivated by the assumption of locality. So the idea is that because of special relativity, I assume that whatever I do over here can't possibly influence things over there. So I assume I can, one, attribute definite properties of things over there independently of these. And secondly, I assume that they don't get disturbed when I do something over here. And so Einstein put it more concisely, and I think this is sometimes called Einstein locality, that the real factual situation of the system S2 is independent of what is done with the system S1 when it is spatially separated from the former. So now, for Bohr, who wrote this kind of what's now considered to be the standard kind of refutation of the EPR argument, the point is, for Bohr, this wasn't really a problem, because Bohr has this peculiar way of just saying, look, you just can't talk about these things, right? It's not allowed to talk about these properties unless you're doing that kind of measurement. So I'm not doing an SZ measurement, then I'm not allowed to talk about SZ properties. And so by taking this kind of hard view of really limiting what you're allowed to say, he's basically rejecting the assumptions of EPR's argument. So he's rejecting their counterfactual reasoning. And look, you can't talk about SX and SZ both being attributed to simultaneous reality, because at the end of the day, you're going to either be doing an SX measurement or you're going to be doing an SZ measurement. Those are exclusive situations. And so your reasoning is fallacious, or your assumptions are your reasoning is not sound because your assumptions are invalid. So just to give you a quote of what he said, the finite interaction between object and measuring agencies conditioned by the very existence of the quantum of action entails, because of the impossibility of controlling the reaction of the object on the measuring instruments if these are to serve their purpose, I love Bohr, the necessity of a final renunciation of the classical ideal of causality and the radical revision of our attitude towards the problem of physical reality. While there is no question of a mechanical disturbance of the system under investigation, so he has no problem with the locality assumption, there is essentially the question of an influence on the very conditions which define the possible types of predictions regarding the future behavior of the system. So again, this tortured language is because he doesn't want to talk about properties, right? He wants to talk about, approaches to observation and methods of observation and the conditions for those observations. So it's really, input-output information is all you can talk about. I don't know if I'll just go through this. Recapitulating the impossibility of subdividing the individual quantum effects and separating a behavior of the objects from the interaction with the measuring instruments serving to define the conditions under which the phenomena appear implies an ambiguity in assigning conventional attributes to atomic objects, which calls for a reconsideration of our attitude towards the problem of physical explanation. Okay. So you can see how it's difficult to kind of parse Bohr. In my view, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I think basically for Bohr, EPR wasn't a problem at all. So if you accept Bohr's philosophy, then EPR is not a problem. But I think it's pretty clear that the EPR consideration is a major problem for the orthodox view, which is the only one that kind of, at least on the face of it, makes sense to me. And basically, there's a much easier way to see this, which Einstein himself emphasized. The EPR argument is kind of unnecessary to make this point, which is that, look, we already saw that we're forced into the conclusion on the orthodox view that the collapse of the wave function is some kind of physical transformation. So that means if you have a wave function extended through space and it collapses when a particle is measured and gets localized, that's a transformation that happens non-locally. I mean, it's instantaneously through space. So right there, you see that the physical, the ontology of the world is changing in a non-local way. Just for a single particle, you don't even need composite systems. But this this non-locality is even more explicit when you think about spatially separated particles in entangled state. It really, you know, draws the point even more strongly that there is some kind of violent non-locality in the orthodox interpretation. Before I get to that, let me just say something which I'll say again later, I guess, but you know, by far the common view, and you probably all heard about Bell's theorem, and it shows that hidden variables are non-local. You know, what's amazing is that by far people think, look, you take as two exclusive possibilities. Either quantum states are complete in the orthodox. So forget about Bohr for the moment. So let's assume that there's some reality we can always talk about. And either it's given by the orthodox view, or it's given by some hidden variables. So Bell's theorem went and showed that if you take a hidden variable view, then you're stuck with non-locality. Those hidden variables must change non-locally. And so people took that to be a refutation of the idea of hidden variables. It's very common for people to say that. And an endorsement somehow of the view that there are no hidden variables and that quantum mechanics are, in the states, are a complete description of reality. But what's missed in that is really the original EPR argument showed that, no, if you take the view that quantum states are complete, then you have non-locality. So it's kind of like, you know, you're between a rock and a hard place, so to speak, where either horn of the dilemma leads to non-locality. And so we'll lead up to this now. So remember, we considered the version of the EPR argument that Bohm devised, and he actually devised it in his 1951 textbook on quantum theory. And somehow, and I couldn't follow the argument, but he actually concludes that it's impossible to construct a hidden variable theory. So he says, we can now use some of the results of the analysis of the paradox of EPR to help prove that quantum theory is inconsistent with the assumption of hidden causal variables. We can, you know, he makes some argument based on the uncertainty principle. We can, and maybe actually it's along the lines of what you were getting at, Emil. But he says, we conclude that no theory of mechanically determined hidden variables can lead to all of the results of quantum theory. So this is just such a great irony, because 1 year later, he published the first hidden variable theory of quantum mechanics, which is called the causal, you know, a causal hidden variable theory, called a suggested interpretation of the quantum theory in terms of hidden variables. So obviously, he acknowledged that argument was wrong. And of course, the hidden variable theory he came up with was explicitly non-local. And we're going to see Roderick Tomolka will describe this view to us in the coming mid-February event. So, you know, whether or not you accept Bohmian mechanics, which, you know, I don't necessarily accept it, but I think what it is, it's very illustrative in the sense that it gives you an idea of what can be done in terms of giving a more complete ontological understanding of the world. It's certainly not unique. So the point I just made over the last slide is exactly this point here, which is that for Einstein, the whole point was that there was a conflict between, you know, either you believe that the quantum wave function was complete, or you believed in locality, but you couldn't believe in both. And of course, once we have the results of John Bell from the late 60s, we find out that basically you're forced to reject the assumption of locality. If you want to make ontological commitments, unlike Bohr, who's kind of anti-realist, if you want to talk about properties independent of observation, an ontology independent of observation, then you have to reject locality, you know, whether or not you believe or don't believe the assumption that quantum wave function is complete. So that's really the point. Is, I thought Alain Aspect made the point really well in the documentary, where he goes, basically, if you want to construct a picture of the world based on quantum mechanics, we now know that that picture has to be non-local. And of course, the other option is just deny that there's such a picture, right? Just deny that there's some kind of independent reality, which is more or less what Bohr does. And there's this third way, which is the many worlds way, which I don't even know how to make sense of that if that's an ontological view, because it's kind of this, you know, there are many ontologies rather than just one. So it avoids these issues in a kind of by endorsing kind of a bizarre ontology. So just to summarize, some of the major points we've seen and the orthodox view, which is that it basically, you know, asserts that the wave function gives the complete ontology of the world. And this leads to a theory with two fundamentally incompatible dynamical laws. I emphasize the word dynamical is key here, because we're thinking of them, the projection postulate, which you know many of you know already, we can think of not as a dynamical law. But in this view, it is a dynamical law. There's an uncertain distinction of at what time and place each of these laws should be applicable in the process of a measurement. There's an awkward ambiguity as to whether or not things like cats have a definite existence. You need the notion of an observer and this divide between the observed world and the observing world. And you have this loss of causality, so you have this fundamental randomness. And so amazingly, all of these properties, which are often attributed to be properties of quantum mechanics, the point is these are consequences of certain interpretational assumptions. So not part of the empirical content of quantum mechanics, as far as we know. So I have a couple more slides kind of leading into the next lecture, but this is probably a good time to maybe have some discussion about any of the issues. Sonia?
You've listed these as all separate bullet points, but I imagine that they're fairly interconnected.
Yeah, I'm not claiming these are independent.
I guess what I'm wondering is how would you group them?
So here's the thing.
I already feel like, to some extent, I've been kind of flogging a dead horse with this whole discussion where, I mean, there's so much absurdity to me that it's almost not even worth the mental effort to do that. But I think it's important to go through this somewhat pedantically because it is kind of, you know, if you go to the library and pick a textbook on quantum mechanics, you're going to get this point of view. So it is kind of the dominant perspective of, you know, what we should think about quantum mechanics in the world. So, I don't know. I mean, so I don't really know how to sort these. I would rather not even try.
Is that, remember your name?
I'm not sure. If you don't want the quantum state to have a complete ontology, and you don't need hidden variables to have complete determinism, why do you have to drop locality in that case?
If you don't believe it's complete. Well, we haven't proven that yet. That's Bell's theorem. If I understood you correctly. So when you assume there are further hidden variables which underlie the quantum description, then Bell showed that no matter what you assume about those hidden variables, the values of those variables, which means the actual properties of the world, will have to change depending on what I choose to measure remotely.
Hidden variables is if you want to determine like some kind of determinism somewhere in there, causality, but if you don't care about the causality, so you don't need hidden variables.
So this is an important point.
So actually the key issue is not really determinism and causality. The key issue is whether or not there are properties. So the whole Bell inequality discussion is independent of any assumptions about determinism and causality. You can actually construct stochastic hidden variable models which don't have a deterministic evolution, which reproduce quantum mechanics, and which are non-local. So really the crux of the issue is if you assume there are hidden variables at all, then those hidden variables have to be non-local. And so, but the motivation for hidden variables, I mean, for some people, the motivation might be to construct a deterministic theory. I mean, certainly that has nice properties and it's appealing in many ways. But it turns out, even if you have more modest ambitions and you know let go of the determinism requirement and just want to say, I want to be able to say that there's some reality independent of observation, that there's a single reality and that it's independent of observation, and I want to construct a theory which reproduces quantum mechanics and which has mathematical elements which are, you know, give this surjective map which actually says that there's a, for each element of reality, there exists a corresponding mathematical element in the theory that I can point to, then it turns out that those physical elements have to be have to change in a non-local way, which means that if when I create entangled states and I perform some operation over here, the physical state of affairs can change over there in a way that's outside of the light cone. So that we know that for sure. So which makes a lot of people think, well, let's forget about hidden variables, and that's too unnatural. And this is really the important point, is that, well, then what else are you going to say? Are you going to take the orthodox view? And then if you take the orthodox view, you still have non-local changes. So it hasn't bought you. You haven't avoided non-locality. So really, you're stuck either with a many worlds kind of ontology, which means you give up the notion of a single reality, which to me is a stronger thing to give up than locality. Or you deny that there's a reality, which is also, to me, much more radical than the assumption of non-locality. What do you think?
I have a question about that. I mean, it's in the statement, though.
I don't know what you think, though.
The actual experiments show that we have non-local correlations. So regardless of what your ontology is, the fact is we have non-local correlations. So if you have hidden variables, they have to be non-local. Mm-hmm. If you take a board interpretation and say that we can't talk about the reality of the wave function, nevertheless, you still have to explain the non-local correlations. So,
I think the
fact that you still have non-locality, regardless of what your interpretation is, right?
So I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, but I do know that people who actually believe these other views, like who take an anti-real, like I think Chris Fuchs, for example, would not accept that the world is non-local because of the peculiarities of his interpretation. So I would encourage you to challenge him on this point, because I'd like to understand better how you'd get around it. Also, many worlds, I think, many worlds doesn't believe that they're non-local, although I'm not entirely sure about that. But I would definitely ask the many worlds speaker, Lev Weidman, how do you make sense, you know, is your theory non-local and how do you avoid saying it is? The point is, again, these are notions where the notion of reality itself comes into question, the kind of a naive notion that there is some reality independent of observation. So when you drop that assumption, I think it's really hard to reason logically about whether things are local or not, because it's not even clear if they exist, right? So, you know, if you have, you know, existence is being created by acts of observation, then I think all bets are off in terms of not even meaningful to talk about locality or non-locality. You don't even have something that it is you can ascribe that property to. But yeah, I definitely encourage you to challenge the speakers on those topics. Okay, we'll go on the last couple of slides then. So, you know, were these issues satisfactorily resolved? Were you know the answer to this? No. So even Richard Feynman, you know, a Nobel laureate we all know and love, is quoted as saying, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. And so where do we go from here? So this is kind of the lead into the next lecture. Of course, we leave it to Albert. So Einstein's view is that there exists, however, a simple psychological reason for the fact that the most nearly obvious ensemble interpretation is being shunned. For if the statistical quantum theory does not pretend to describe the individual system completely, it appears unavoidable to look elsewhere for a complete description of the individual system. Assuming the successive efforts to accomplish a complete physical description, the statistical quantum theory would, within the framework of future physics, take an approximately analogous position to the statistical mechanics with the framework of classical mechanics. I'm rather firmly convinced the development of theoretical physics will be of that type, but the path will be lengthy and difficult. So there, the gauntlet is thrown. He even said that before he knew about Bell's result, which is that it's going to be a non-local situation, which is even more challenging kind of mathematically and physically. So this leads us into the next lecture, where we will talk about kind of modern approaches to hidden variables and you know, what we can and can't say about them, the fact that they're non-local, we'll discuss Bell's theorem, the fact that they're contextual, which basically means that it's under reasonable assumptions, it's hard to ascribe a reality that's independent of context that you think reality should not depend on. One other thought about this quote, which is, so I didn't understand this the first, you know, few times I've read it, but I think what he's getting at here about this psychological analysis is that the people he's arguing with in this, over, you know, his adult life, are people like Bohr and von Neumann and Dirac and Pauli. These are people who created the theory. So for them, I think what he's saying here, and just me reading between the lines, is that, you know, these guys, they don't want to acknowledge the possibility that quantum theory is a phenomenological theory because it's their theory, right? They want it to be the end of the story. They want to write the final, you know, the final chapter on the laws of nature. And so they don't even want to go down this path Einstein is promoting, that, look, we've only come up with a phenomenological description. We need something deeper. So I think that's what he's getting at there. And I find it easy to believe that that was part of the problem. Okay, great. Let me finish with some questions then, if anybody else has discussion topics.
I just finished reading as a recent biography of Dirac. And such a surprising degree of modesty that he exhibits sort of after that 8-year period when he produced his most spectacular work. In particular, he mentions, no, this is a preliminary theory, quantum theory.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure that's in his later editions of his book, but in his comments at that time, it was sort of a 20-year period after that, it was pretty clear that he did not think that this was
interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised. But.
Because he did ascribe these really strong ontological commitments to the mathematics of the theory. So. And by Neumann, too, at that one quote I showed, he acknowledged the possibility that quantum theory could not be the right answer because it only answered things in a halfway satisfactory manner in 1932. But yet still he had this strong attachment to the ontological views about the quantum state. Chris, did you?
Oh, just along the same lines you saying that, so Einstein's going against people who sort of want to protect their legacy. But now if you want to go against quantum mechanics, you're going against people whose funding and social connections and lots of strong, real, you know, things that are daily, you know, that you hold dear. Now you're going against that.
That's probably true too, but to some extent I think quantum mechanics is so spectacularly successful now. It's so obvious the theory has been tested in a million different ways and nothing ever disagrees with it, at least not in a way we can't understand by considering, you know, open quantum systems. It's kind of slowly, the situation is slowly being cornered into a situation where, sure, you might be able to find such a physical theory, which a hidden variable theory like de Broglie-Bohm, but at the end of the day, its task is just to reproduce the predictions we already know quantum mechanics makes. So it's just kind of, you know, a gentle pillow, as Einstein would say. It just gives you some nice picture, some nice way of thinking about the world, maybe a consistent way of reasoning about quantum mechanics. But it's not so clear it's going to give you more in terms of practical predictions. Now, the one exception to that is this, you know, huge elephant in the room, which is, you know, quantum theory and general relativity as they stand are incompatible. There's no way to describe a system with both theories at the same time, with both phenomena at the same time. You can't have a back-reacting description of a theory that's both subject to quantum mechanics and subject to gravitational interactions. And so maybe, big maybe, is that part of solving that puzzle will be from having a better picture of what the ontology is or what the possibilities of ontology are. It's probably underdetermined by quantum mechanics, is what we see. So.
Another question might be that why is it that when you want to construct a theory that reproduces quantum mechanics, you need to reproduce the mathematical structure? Is there ever a proof that says, no, the real predictions that I make in the lab are necessarily given by this Hilbert space, very rigid structure of Hilbert space? Because all these proofs that say, no, you can't do this, you know, assume this very rigid structure of quantum mechanics. Whereas,
well, I don't know if it's so rigid. I mean, you know, so Alex Wilczy is going to come talk about this convex sets framework, which shares a lot of common mathematical elements with quantum mechanics, but it allows for more general classical theories. And also classical mechanics, as you should know, fits into the Hilbert space formalism as well, real Hilbert space formalism, where transformations are unitary and so on. So I think one thing I would say about that is I find it very common for people to say when they want to use like an axiomatic derivation of quantum mechanics from physical principles, they'll often kind of say, I don't know if it's seriously or casually, but they'll say, you want to derive Hilbert space from physical principles.
And by that, they mean quantum mechanics. But I think that's not really the right way to think about quantum mechanics as being characterized by Hilbert space, because classical mechanics and a whole bunch of other theories are also Hilbert space theories. The Hilbert space mathematical structure is extremely broad. You know, it's
broader than quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it's broader than quantum mechanics, and most any linear theory is going to fit into it, basically. So, I don't know, there's a few thoughts off the top of my head, I guess.
Luke? I probably should have asked this question 2 slides ago, but when you were talking about what the conditions necessary to have a non-locality, the last thing you mentioned was that you need to ascribe an element of physical reality to elements in quantum mechanics, in your theory. I was wondering if you reject that idea, if you don't believe that quantum mechanics actually describes physical reality, is that just taking Bohr's like operationalist view, or is that something different? And if so, does that still lead to non-locality? Like, how stringent is that condition?
Yeah, so this was brought up by the question in the back as well. So it's not clear to me. So first of all, you have the argument backwards from what I said. So the idea is not that kind of every element of the theory has to quantum. I don't know how you said it, but
I mean, like every element of reality should have a corresponding element.
Yes, that's the word. Yeah. Right. So the idea is, you said if you have some prior commitment or belief or assumption that such a thing is real. Like the coffee cup, and I'm going to describe it quantum mechanically, then I always want there to be something in the theory that points to, that's the role of interpretation, to say, look, this piece of the theory, this is what's really going on. So I want a piece of the theory to correspond to what I'm assuming is going on, which is that there is a cup right there. But yeah, when you deny reality, then you get, I think you probably can get around.
That was kind of a question, though. Is it that you're denying reality, or are you just denying quantum mechanics' validity in describing reality? If you just deny quantum mechanics as a description of physical reality, but still believe in a reality, my question is what kind of interpretation is that?
You're walking some kind of fine line between Bohr and Einstein there, because they would both say, yes, quantum mechanics does not give a description of the kind of traditional reality we think of. So Bohr says that's because you can't talk about the reality of those objects, whereas Einstein would say it's because they have a reality, but quantum mechanics isn't giving the description of it.
Okay.
See what I mean? So
right.
There's two ways to go there. I think they both would agree that if there's that absence of a connection, and Bohr would say it's because there is no reality to be ascribed, and Einstein would say, no, if there is a reality, but quantum mechanics is just not ascribing it.
But even given that, any deeper theory still has to be non-local.
Any deeper theory in the sense of something that provides any kind of unique ontology, unlike many worlds, which has a kind of a non-unique ontology, I know what the right words are for it, but yeah, any kind of reasonable interpretation is non-local.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to formalize that later. So, we're going to talk about hidden variables within the context of, what nowadays people call the ontological model framework, which is a way of accommodating both the orthodox view and hidden variable views. And I'll try and create a little classification of interpretations, which will be very, pretty much a draft, which we'll hopefully maybe revisit at the end of the class after everyone spoke to us.
Yeah, Ian? You talked about the subjection from the mathematics onto the reality. Does anybody take the notion that such a subjection isn't necessary because you can just consider reality to actually be a subset of mathematics?
Well, that sounds a lot like what the orthodox view is, right?
But are there two categories of the orthodox view, one where you need a subjection, one where you don't?
I think the orthodox view would deny a subjection. It would just say that, look, I'm not going to take an independent notion of reality into the discussion. I'm just going to let quantum mechanics tell me what's real to some extent. It's kind of a reverse of the problem. It's just start from the theory, it's kind of this. You can say, look, these things I believe are real, let me find them in theory. Or you can say, look, when we start from the theory, I'll interpret the theory and then I'll let it tell me what's real. But there's some literature, not a platonic reality of mathematics and all that, which I'm not versed in, so I don't know much about it. So I can't help you there. Okay, I guess that's it. So I guess on Thursday then we'll be back at IQC and we will look at kind of constraints on hidden variable models.